Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, October 10th was World Mental Health Day, and I'm just extending it to World Mental Health October for me because, you know, the way that we take care of each other, take care of ourselves is really important. And I think that the conversation about self-help has sort of devolved to a place where it's like this individualism. People think they can, like, truck everything. They can do it on their own, and they can, like, keep a truck in, and da-da-da. The reality is we need each other. And more importantly, we need to be able to process the world around us with somebody that we can trust. And that was therapy for me. It is therapy for me. And I didn't think it was going to be. I remember when it felt like the world was falling apart with something that happened to me in 2020. And I was like, oh, I need help beyond my friends. My friends are incredible, but I just need another person to talk to who is skilled and equipped to help me navigate the world. And I couldn't be a bigger fan of therapy. That, like, we don't have to do this alone, that our mental health is something that is not only a thing we sort of try and figure out ourselves, that we have to rough it through, or that we only talk to our friends about. We can actually get professional support. And that is why I recommend BetterHelp. With BetterHelp, you can find therapists of all types, backgrounds, expertise. They have over 30,000 therapists. It's the world's largest online therapy platform. And they've served over 5 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. And the cool thing is that you can switch therapists at any time, easy to sign up. Like, it really does make it easy for you to find a therapist. In this World Mental Health Post Day, but I'm calling it the month, we're celebrating the therapists who've helped millions of people take a step forward. If you're ready to find the right therapist for you, BetterHelp can start that journey. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's better. HELP.com/people. Hey, this is DeRay. We're going to pause here for the people. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to cover the underreported news with regard to race, justice, culture, and equity. And then I sat down with the acclaimed author and historian LaShawn Harris to talk about her new book, Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. I learned a lot in this conversation. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People to stay updated with all things Pod Save the People. Here we go. California voters, on November 4th, you'll vote on Prop 50. It's a ballot measure to stop Trump from power grabbing extra seats in the U.S. House and hanging on to his federal trifecta. The best way to make sure Prop 50 passes is to, one, vote yes on November 4th, and two, make sure everyone you know knows about the election. Vote Save America is hosting an event on Wednesday, October 15th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time to get you up to speed to take action that night. And you don't have to live in California to join. Have families or friends in California? Join VSA's call and learn about how to motivate them to get out to vote. Sign up by going to votesaveamerica.com/prop50. Paid for by Vote Save America. Votesaveamerica.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. We are back for another great week in this great United States of America. This is Dre at DREY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn, on Instagram at Bossier Shay, or on Spill at Bossier S.
So let's just start. Let's jump in. There's a lot to talk about. We did not talk about Diddy fully, but, you know, now that he has been sentenced, he is petitioning to be in a low security facility in New Jersey. What do y'all think about what has happened around the Diddy trial? It seems like he, you know, it's not clear that he'll serve the whole time, the 4 years that he is. I think it's 4 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 4 years that he's been given.
Time served. Yep.
with credit for time served. But, you know, there are a lot of people who didn't think he'd get this much time. He's obviously said that these charges or what he was convicted of was not as serious, and he was acquitted on the most serious charges. You probably saw that Cassie wrote a letter saying that she is still worried about him being a threat. And he did apologize to Cassie and a host of other people in the sentencing process. But what are your takes on what has happened now that the trial is over?
I think it's weird how much it feels like this whole Diddy situation feels like light years away. Mm-hmm. I think when the Diddy story first dropped, it really shook everything up. We had a different president. And now it just kind of feels, I don't know. I don't want to say like empty, but it does kind of feel empty. It feels like we have like bigger things in front of us now. And it also feels like, I don't know. Like, I think the sentencing was probably right. I think that he probably is a danger to people. I believe Cassie. I believe that he probably won't be so bold to do maybe some of the stuff that he was accused of doing on the violent organized crime side. But when I think about like corporate and financial revenge, I definitely think that he's in on some of that, or he's going to be doing some of that. And I think the only other thing that I think about is just the jury, how I think that them not necessarily seeing the story of abuse or the story of organized crime happening in what Diddy was accused of does tell a feminist story, and it's a sad feminist story about where the actual public is when it comes to understanding sexual crimes, organized crimes, and powerful men.
Yeah, on that organized crime piece, I listen to a lot of true crime. I'm blaming my grandmother for exposing me to Matlock early in my life. But one of the sort of true crime tropes is that Black people can't be serial killers. And one of the reasons for that is because in the U.S., we are so obsessed with the idea of serial killers as these mad geniuses. And Black people are never seen as intelligent enough, right, to even be genius enough to be your Ted Bundys, to be charming enough to be your Jeffrey Dahmers, right? Which I know sounds dark, but there is a little bit of like, in order to be participating in organized crime, the level of like coordination and orchestration that has to take place, people do not think most Black people, even rich and powerful ones, capable of, right? So first you have to get them to a place where they think Diddy is smart enough, capable enough, connected enough, resourced enough, right? To sort of have all of these people at his beck and call and willing to do those things before they can even say, okay, if we think he's capable of that, do we think he did it in this instance? And I think some of that is part of what's happening, right? Like I do think part of what happened in this trial is that people saw him as a rapper and not as a mogul, right? And I think that actually worked to his benefit when it came to what he was convicted of, right? It's like he's some thug, and thugs are not actually capable of participating in this kind of racketeering that he is being accused of. I don't have anything else to say around like the sentence or the sentencing. I will say that the work that his people did to create these like glossy videos about him as like a family man with responsibility for caring for all that other stuff was just gross. And so, yeah.
You know, you got me on that, Sharonda. I didn't know where you were going with this sort of serial killer thing. I was like, you know, I'm along for the ride. This is interesting. But racism is really something. The idea that Black people can't even be smart enough to be, I mean, not that that is a goal, but.
No, yes.
That's interesting. I do think you're right, too. And, you know, if Diddy has done anything well his entire career, it is he has managed the public incredibly well. Mm-hmm. He has been in control of his image and the way people understood him. The fact that we all called him Puffy and then Diddy and then P Diddy, like all, and then Love at the very end was like a great way to try and get in front. Like, you knew this was coming. So then you rebrand as Love itself is just, he's been very, very mindful of that. That's why I don't think, as much as I think accountability is, you know, long overdue for all of these people in Hollywood, I don't think this is Diddy's last act. I think that we will, you know, Trump already said that he requested a pardon. Trump said that because Diddy has said some mean things about him in the past, it is unlikely. So that just to me seems like if Diddy comes out and is a hardcore Trumper, then like that seems like an option. And, you know, that feels like it's on the table for Diddy for sure. I don't think he has any like value that would make him not be a Trumper. So I don't know, but I don't think this is Diddy's last act. I think there are some more Diddy moments happening.
If Breezy Bowl is any indication, Diddy will be Diddy bopping on somebody's stage in a couple of years without question.
You know, in terms of somebody who the bus has just run over, I hadn't even thought about Katie Porter in a long time. But whoever Katie Porter pissed off on her own team, they said, let me show you what the real Katie Porter is like. Because the way she responded to that interviewer, who was just, you know, I feel like you should be used to interviews at this point. And then the way she snapped on that staff member in that Zoom call, Katie, it's looking a little shady, Katie. It's looking a little shady.
I liked it.
Miles, of course
I liked it. It is weird because, well, tinfoil hat, but I think there are people who do not want her to win. And I think that the bad publicity is organized. Now, she gave them the material to create the bad publicity, so you can't do that. But I'm not a Californian. I'm not there to do the temperature check, but so I'll lean on Sharonda. But to me, how it feels is we're not in a space where we care about people cursing out their staff or people saying, you know what, I'm not answering that question or whatever. I think that at the bet, at the most favorable, I think a lot of people see those moments as somebody who is focused, passionate, and says what she means. I think that that also aligns with the brand and the whiteboard and what kind of electrocuted people around her to begin with. And then I think there's so much space to be inappropriate now that Trump's in office. So it's really hard to like paint her with a certain type of brush when we have some of the most ridiculous people. I mean, what, like, I don't even think we talked about somebody calling Jasmine Crockett a black or a ghetto black or whatever. Like, I think that there's just so much space for inappropriate behavior, and how her inappropriate behavior was expressed kind of left me feeling a little warm and fuzzy. I'm like, yeah, do that to some Republicans. Sorry for the staffers, but I also wouldn't be a staffer for
a
politician.
Sorry for the staffers. It's hilarious.
Sorry for the staffers. I'm sorry to that staffer.
Okay. Building on
your
tinfoil hat moment. Do we think that this is because she was becoming a real power player in the Democratic Party?
Oh my God, these tinfoil hats. I'm not... I'm taking off guard. My two tinfoil hats on one.
I'm just asking questions. You know, do we think that this has anything to do with her rising star outside of California and as a member of the party and someone who was seen as a contender for the governor seat here?
I don't know. I think what makes me nervous about it, and there's a part of the honesty that I'm like intrigued by. This is, I have no tinfoil hat. Let me just, for the record, say that. I do, but not on Katie. But I'm like, if you would be like this, or I've had crazy bosses.
Yeah.
If you would be like this recorded, I can only imagine what you're like when nobody's watching and
but
I'm not
cares?
Here for it.
If we're with pedophiles, if Epstein list is not going, if we're not talking about what Bill Clinton might have done.
On our side, we need it. Our values have to stay intact, even if the other people's values are screwed up.
I don't think I agree with that. I think that there's like, you know, shout out to Palestine and the ceasefire. But I think that all those type of morals and minutia around morals and ethics have totally been washed when you couldn't figure out how to credit.
I think the idea of like treating your staff as not as property is a value that we should keep. And that is not like about whether the politicians sort of were right on Palestine or not.
I think if she can do her job and she knows what she's doing, she should be elected. And I think that if you Californians let American Psycho, become your governor, knowing good and well he ain't gonna sign that reparations bill just because she cursed out them staff. Y'all are fools.
Oh my God.
I don't agree with that. I'm not saying that. This is a wild episode. I'm not saying that. But y'all remember when Amy Klobuchar a few years ago got in trouble for doing something similar? She had been like yelling at her staff, and there was this whole incident where she ate a salad with a comb or something like that, that kind of, you know, because someone forgot to bring her utensils. And Amy Klobuchar seems to be doing just fine, you know? So I don't think it will derail Katie's career. I think it's probably the start of something. And it'll be interesting to see what else comes out. But yeah, you should not berate your staff, y'all. That's not what we're saying.
Yeah, and I'm not saying you should.
I'm
not saying you should do it. I'm talking as if I am somebody whose health insurance payments are too high. I'm talking about if I'm somebody who's in California living poor, should this be the thing that makes you choose Gavin? No. Or whatever somebody else is? No. Like, look at what she's doing. Look at what she's telling you she's going to do and go for that. Like, that
I guess fair. And I think, saying. I mean, we all know enough people that Lord knows if there were some cameras on these other people, you certainly wouldn't be voting for them either. So,
yeah.
And Ezra Klein just talked about wanting all types of wild characters to go into Democratic Party, like that are just outside of the ethics boundary of being even a neoliberal. Like, so I'm like, if y'all doing that,
Ezra is our, you know, is the guide. But before we jump into the news, I did want to talk about our home girl, sister girl, leader friend, Auntie Kamala, and the book tour, because the book was a splash and the tour has been even more of a splash. She said that motherfuckers is crazy without the beeped out word. Do you think that, you know, she also seems pretty committed to running again and that she's not out of the game, that, you know, she's still a leader in the party? And before I say what I think about that, I'd love to know what y'all think about that.
I think we talked about this a little bit last week when we said, or when I said, I think anyway, that it feels like she's trying to lean into this like authenticity, you know, that people seem to want or wanted from her. I think it'll be interesting to see how that language and the way that she feels just a little more like loose and free plays in the sort of more respectable and particularly the more respectable Black wing of the party, right? Because when she ran the first time, you know, all of the Divine Nine organizations were out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it'll just be fascinating to see if they show up with the same level of enthusiasm if she does run again, given how she's shown up on this particular leg of the tour, right? Or are people going to be like, oh, that's a bridge too far for me. You can't cuss and use habitual B on a on a stage. So I'll be very curious to see how that plays with Black voters and particularly middle-class Black voters.
Yeah, I think she has the middle-class Black voters in the back. I think obviously
no matter what,
the Democrat. And I don't think cursing is gonna stop people, because we Black people do we speak wink wink too. So yeah. So we also
that's a good title. We speak wink wink too. Yeah. You won that. That was my episode over.
So we do, I think that we would understand what she's doing. Yeah, I just have not been inspired by anything that she said. I think I was expecting, y'all know how I feel when I'm not being broadcasted, so I'm trying to translate that in my head in a way that's not as inflammatory. I don't understand the goals of the book tour. Now, if the goals of the book tour is just to activate and reactivate the people who already voted for you, sure, in hopes that the other people who maybe were, I guess the hope is that the people who stayed home, specifically the college-educated white men who stayed home, who normally would vote Democrat, would be so activated by everything that Trump has going on that they would go to the polls. But I don't see her trying to gain back favor from anybody who she offended. I see her making a lot, setting herself up and making a lot of excuses for her decision making. I see that when it comes to how she's addressing Palestine. I feel like that's how she is when she addressed, you know, not that she was addressing me specifically, but like, but like the kind of critique people had of Megan Thee Stallion, she flipped it in such a dishonest way that it actually made me look at her character different.
Like, can you explain explain how she flipped it?
Yeah, so she flipped Megan Thee Stallion, where she brought Megan Thee Stallion out for her campaigning, and people had critiques of it, and she flipped people's critiques into thinking that, oh, I was making a non-traditional, non-traditional choice, and traditionalists said this was a bad choice. And sure, maybe that is a truth, but that totally flattens the critique. I know people who mirror my politics or mirror my identities who had the same critiques, and it was not coming from a traditionalist space. It came from the space of you not having not one Black trans person, you not having any more diverse Black women representations throughout your campaign. And then when you do have them, they're all celebrities, and the one celebrity and the other celebrities, namely Megan Thee Stallion, is over there twerking. And it looks like you are trying to utilize minstrelsy in order to kind of show us that you're down. And that is what white people do. That's what white people do and fail at. So, like, we see that too. And you're doing it, and that feels odd. And you're not addressing that. And you're not saying, you know what? I pulled all my resources together, and I wanted to, you know, I listened to The Quiet Storm, y'all. I'm not going to play with y'all. So I didn't know really where to go. And I got Megan Thee Stallion, and it was a misstep. Any of those things, I would have been like, okay, mm-hmm. Auntie Kamala. Like, I hear you. But you didn't. She just made it seem like the critiques of her were from people who just didn't understand her innovative new way of doing politics. And minstrelsy is not an innovative new way to do politics. It's actually very old and tired, which is how come people stayed home, because it was tired and weren't galvanized to go anywhere.
I think her strategy is actually to create the space so she can do whatever she wants and not be aligned to the party when she runs again. Like, not be beholden to the party infrastructure. So I think all of the things that people hate about this book tour or are frustrated by, like that answer, how she's dealing with the Palestinian protesters, I think they'll actually forget it by the time she is politically important again, like in the electoral sense. But I think they'll remember she was honest. She was herself. It wasn't the consultants. She got to do what she wanted to do. It wasn't Biden. Like, that is what I think their intent is with this tour. Whether it's successful or not, I don't know. But I do think that's what they're trying to do.
So because she's somebody who is probably going to, like, she's going to do this book tour, then she probably will disappear and then try to get reelected, this will be in the memory. And honestly, you see how it happens with everybody. And when you kind of move like that, people update and refresh the last thing that they got you on. So yeah, we kind of do live in this society, like in this like culture where people forget things quickly. But when it comes to her in this big gap, because she's not filling the space and she's not on podcast every week, and this is just for one cycle, people are going to go back. Like, it's going to be extremely hard to live down her eras. And because she's not taking this as a moment to remedy that, she's going to still have to address it. And I think that if she runs again, she's going to get ate up. And then, mind you, she wasn't popular during primaries. I kind of forget that because of how the last election happened. But I forget that even before any of the madness happened, she already wasn't popular. So I don't see that future for her. But shout out to Wes Moore.
Oh, you are crazy. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mosh. Now, I sort of became a gym guy sort of randomly. I was like, you know, let me see if I can do this for a day. I got a good coach. Shout out to my coach, my original coach a couple years ago. And I got in the gym. And I realized quickly that, like, working out was part of it, but what I put in my body was also the other half of it. And I think about things like protein, which I just didn't even, like, think about well. Like, I just didn't understand. And then I started doing protein bars and all these other things, and not everything tastes good. But some of them actually taste great. And that's how we get to Mosh Bars. Because Mosh, which you might have heard about on Shark Tank, they're founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger, with the simple mission to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with the debilitating disease. Now, Mosh is the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. And the cool thing is that Mosh bars actually taste great. So they come in 9 mouthwatering flavors, including 3 new plant-based flavors, chocolate chip cookie, hazelnut chocolate chip, and peanut chocolate chip. And here's like the feel-good part of it. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Why gender-based? Because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. And like I said, these are great protein bars. They taste great. And all of you that go to the gym, you know you got to get your protein in. Head to moshlife.com/PSDP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack or the new plant-based trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on either the bestsellers trial pack or the plant-based trial pack at moshlife.com/PSDP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring the episode.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Let's jump into the news. I wanted to talk about Turning Point USA, which you all know because Charlie Kirk started it and, you know, the right-wing billionaires who funded it. And they, now it's run by his wife, which everybody knew that. But they are really worked up about this Bad Bunny thing, which again is just the culture wars. Like, I don't think they actually care, but I do think they are like stoking the fire, which is why ICE is going to be at the Super Bowl. I appreciate that the NFL has pushed back pretty hard. Like, the NFL is sort of annoyed with the right-wing rhetoric around this. And, you know, Apple Music and Rock Nation are like doubling down on what they're going to do with Bad Bunny. The Turning Point said that they are actually going to run counter-programming to the Super Bowl show. And they're calling it the All-American Halftime Show, celebrating faith, family, and freedom, and that the musical artists who will be counter-programmed to Bad Bunny will be announced soon. And I just am, you know, I'm like just annoyed by them, but I'm also like, who is going to sign up to be the counter-programming artists? Fascinated to see this list of people who will sign up to be the counter to Bad Bunny. And I hope all of their careers end in a swift, joyous, just join Chrisette Michelle in the abyss.
I still love Chrisette Michelle. I'm not going to lie to you. I play her.
It's okay.
I know, me too. I'm like, girl, there's still time to come home. Okay. On the counter programming, right? I honestly think that most of this is a money grab because I think they anticipate that people, at least news outlets and, you know, will tune in out of curiosity, right? To see what happens over there. Not that they think that anybody is actually going to want to watch whoever this is over Bad Bunny. I mean, look, Bad Bunny, when he did decide that he was going to tour in the continental U.S., was selling out arenas years ago here. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen everybody online say, let me brush up on my Spanish. I'm going to tell you right now, as somebody who speaks Spanish, that's Puerto Rican Spanish, and that's different. But it feels like a cheap money grab to me. And in some ways, I hope that no one covers it because I think that what they are trying to do is not actually provide a counterweight, not actually sort of demonstrate that they are more in demand. I think it's to take advantage of the spotlight that's on the Super Bowl, that is on Bad Bunny in particular, and see what they can, you know, kind of glean from that as people are just curious about it and want to cover it.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about something being produced because the Super Bowl, the halftime show was created because of the success of In Living Color during that time slot. So then they utilized Michael Jackson in order to smash that. And now we might maybe see like a bifurcation. I actually think that it probably could be really successful because I do think the last few Super Bowl performances were so niche and siloed. And I know that that's a because we're in a post-Lemonade Beyonce world, she is seen as deeply racialized and deeply politicized. And I think Bad Bunny, and now that he made those comments, he's seen the same way. So a lot of the, now that we know publicly that Jay-Z's the one who is choosing these people, I think that leaves space for an alternative. And I think there was there's a thirst for the alternative representation. So I wouldn't be so quick to think that it'll be a failure. And I think there's a lot of people who could be really successful at it. I think that Lil Wayne. I think
his feelings are hurt. Yeah,
there's a few people I can think of that might that could probably get a check written for them that could really fuck us up. You know, even when you look at what Nicki Minaj is doing and the kind of rant she's going on and stuff like that. So I think and again, it all could just be all country western, you know, adult contemporary people. But I, you know, as an evil genius, I can think of a few ways that I would that could really fuck up the halftime Super Bowl. But so this story to me is more interesting because Charlie Kirk in Turning Point. This story is interesting to me is because again, you see the right really well creating a controversy because Candace Owens and a whole lot of other right-wing personalities are asking some really interesting questions about Charlie Kirk. I'm even thinking about Theo Vaughn talk and how he's been talking about both Palestine and immigration. So there's a lot of crumbling going on in the right-wing media apparatus online. And what they're doing is instead of addressing any of that that's happening right now, they're taking the bait and creating a controversy and creating something that's bigger than that noise of crumbling. And I just kind of can't believe that there's not more people on the left who are in positions of power who are not teasing this out. I don't understand why people aren't like, let's sit down with Candace Owens and hear what she has to say. They do it all, you know, they do it all the time. Let's just hear what she has to say. Why not? I can't believe they're just kind of like letting this like unravel. When to me, this seems like such a good opportunity to really shake and break the foundation. But I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because I know that AIPAC, Israel, money, they can't really go where Candace Owens and them are going. But it's such a good opportunity though, because they are going bananas on the internet over this, over Charlie Kirk's death.
You know, I had assumed that they would target kind of country western, you know, weirdos, wackos who had no desire to go pop or have any crossover appeal. But your mention of Lil Wayne was like, I mean, shit, if they do Wayne, 50, Nelly, like we might get a late 90s, early 2000s rap nostalgia concert to like battle this, especially because that all feels like it's back in vogue with the young people these days, right? Like 90s nostalgia is having a moment. And I think, Miles, if that is the route they go, it will be successful, right? Because I can even imagine some of my friends being like, I mean, I like Bad Bunny, but I don't know what he's saying. And then putting that on, you know? Mm. Damn. Okay.
That damn was so honest.
damn.
God, we are just...
That was that Esther Rowe damn. Damn.
It really was. That was rough.
Well, my news today is about prediction markets and betting on prediction markets. So I was doom scrolling on Instagram, as I am wont to do again these days, and got an ad that was asking me if I wanted to place a bet on a potential outcome for a New York City election. And I was like, what is this? And it was an ad by a company called Kalshi, but then I dove a little bit deeper into this, learned about this site called Polymarket, which was founded in 2020 by a 21-year-old named Shane Copeland. And so it's not, it's a form where people gamble, yes, but it's different in that it doesn't set the odds. So each quote unquote market is basically a yes or no question. So they've asked questions like, will Volodymyr Zelensky apologize to Trump? Will Fyre Festival 2 sell out? Et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that, the question that catapulted them to sort of fame, so to speak, was they asked the question about whether or not Biden would drop out of the 2024 presidential race. And despite all of the kind of major media outlets saying that they thought Biden was going to stay in and they weren't sure if Trump was going to win, the bettors on Polymarket were very clear. Biden was dropping out and Trump was winning. And so people are like, oh, wait a minute. This might actually be better than some of the other polling sites and polling data that we are looking at. So since then, Polymarket has become the most downloaded free news app from Apple. And it processed more than $3 billion with a B dollars on the 2024 election alone. Nate Silver, who we all know and many of us have strong feelings about, has joined Polymarket as an advisor. Elon Musk has given them a shout out. And again, people feel like some of what they see in terms of odds and bets on Polymarket has really been more accurate than a lot of the sophisticated political polling. Their competitor, which is Kalshi, which is the ad, the company that whose ad I saw, Donald Trump Jr. Joined them as an advisor in January. And so, yeah, it's just interesting because this was some, like, it was like a thing I didn't really have an idea about. I saw an ad and I was like, what is this? And I have just discovered that there's this whole world happening out there. About 90% of all prediction market activity now takes place on Polymarket. It has about 200,000 active users who are trading each day. And it was announced this week that its founder, Shane Copeland, has become the world's youngest, quote unquote, self-made billionaire at 27. So I'm bringing this to the pod because I think it's really interesting to think about people betting on like real life stuff in this way. I also think that we have seen in the US anyway, a growing level of like engagement around gambling, particularly sports betting. And I think about like the addictive nature of gambling in particular. And I think as people become more desperate financially, given all that's happening in the, you know, in our economy right now, everyone's looking for their get rich quick opportunity, which is often extractive of poor people and poor people of color in particular. But this just was not on my radar at all. And so, yeah, wanted to make sure that our listeners had a chance to hear about it, but also welcome y'all's reflections.
This immediately reminds me of The Wisdom of Crowds, great book that came out in the early 2000s, if you've not read it, and based on a theory that is much older. But you know, crowds are way smarter than we give them credit for. And whether it's Polymarket or a million other ways that we can manage like crowdsourcing things, this study from this, the theory came from this old study where I think it was like a crowd was able to determine the median weight of an ox at a fair. Like this is where, this is like the root of this, better than like individual people were. Like the crowd got it right. And The Wisdom of Crowds, the book, does a phenomenal job of noting this phenomenon across societies. And I think it's true. Like, I think the Polymarket is interesting to me in that it uses the stock market to just take crowd wisdom. But I just think about all the other things. I think we know this intuitively in Black. You're like, listen to, like, I think about somebody who's talking about John Fetterman and how the Black people never supported him in he's in Pennsylvania. And it's like, listen to the crowd. Crowds are smarter than we think. And we have done a lot of things to make people think that that is not true. And the rise of individualism might be the end of us all. But I am interested, not necessarily in Polymarket, but how we use that crowd wisdom to make better decisions, especially political decisions. I think about what Miles keeps saying about Kamala. I think this is true of a lot of people. This is what we have joked about with Pete. It's like it actually means something that he polls at 0% with Black people. It's not just like an interesting thing.
Yeah.
It is like an that means something powerful. So that's my only takeaway here. But it also scares me because I'm like, what is going on when the right owns the whole ecosystem? Did y'all see that Barry Weiss is making all of the reporters at CBS send her a memo outlining what they're working on?
This is what people think management and oversight are, but yes, yes.
I'm like, this is crazy.
This is a really interesting story to me. I don't know. I don't feel that optimistic like about it. I think it kind of it feels a little strange to me. I think that we consistently turn politics into entertainment and games, and I think that that makes more brutal choices possible. Mm-hmm. I think that the more distant you feel, or the more if we have this gamification of politics, the more people make these kind of decisions that are oppressive. I think the reason why there's not this uproar around what is happening to Venezuelan ships is because it looks like video games. I think the reason to the average person. I think the reason why we don't feel this way around what we're seeing with ICE agents is because all of this has kind of been flattened to a type of like entertainment game circus. And it does feel a little gross to me. It feels eerie that's where we're at right now. And the other thing that you mentioned, a lot of what's going on with Polymarket is the same thing that revitalized people inside of Bitcoin. So those kind of Bitcoin schemes and stuff like that, they're kind of reproducing those same things. So you do see a lot of people, specifically young men, Gen Z, like millennials, participating in this because there's only so many pathways to class transcendence. And now virtually gambling is really, for a lot of people, the only realistic route to class mobility. Mm-hmm. And it just feels odd to see people betting on it. Because last thing I'll say, because I just kind of want to map it out, because in my head, I'm seeing somebody who is betting on something and betting on politics that might end up hurting them, in hopes that the politics that are hurting them, this bet can get them out of the political choices that are hurting them.
Yeah.
But then more than likely it won't happen. So you're just kind of in that loop because it did happen for somebody, so it could happen for you. And it feels really weird. It feels eerie.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Today's episode is sponsored by Strawberry.me. We all know that you've got to have a job, but what you really want is a career, something that not only provides income, but also a sense of self-worth and accomplishment. If you're feeling stuck in your job and want to level up your career, you should check out Strawberry.me. Strawberry.me is a career coaching service that'll help you move up the ladder, negotiate better pay, or land a job you love in the industry that you're passionate about. You just take a quick quiz, and then Strawberry.me will match you with the career coach who's best suited to help you achieve your goals. With the help of a coach, you'll gain clarity on your goals, ensuring that you're moving toward the career you actually want. Instead of working aimlessly and hoping for the best, you'll develop a plan designed to help you land better opportunities, negotiate higher pay, and position yourself for success. And because real progress doesn't happen without accountability, your coach will help keep you on track so you actually follow through. Strawberry.me gives you the tools you need so that you're the one in control of your career. Head to strawberry.me/PSDP to claim a special offer and get started. That's strawberry.me/PSTP. Stop settling and start building the career you actually want.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
So So this week's news comes from Philly Inquirer, and it comes from Sharonda. Sharonda has been hooking me up, so I feel like she understands my wavelength. So she's been sending me all types of stuff where I'm like, I love this. This is great. This is excellent. And this story is no different. So the story, I'm going to read a little bit from the Instagram, for the Instagram post. So it goes, when Alexa Colas realized she needed more music in her life, she found a simple solution. She turned her living room into a record store and a listening room and a performance space and the set of Philly Cam TV show. It goes on to say, her immersive art installation, Club Friends Radio and Records, I Turn My Living Room Into a Record Store, is featured at the Design Philadelphia Festival, which runs through October 12th, with 68 events at galleries and other spaces all over the city. So I want you all, now that you know that news, I want you all to go look it up, because to see it really is to really feel immersed inside of it. The aesthetic slightly reminds me of the aesthetics that Black Market Vintage have been playing with. Mm-hmm. And it also just reminds me of those kind of mid-century Black aesthetics that I think a lot of us have been playing inside of. I'm even thinking about Hood's mid-century modern. Oh, yeah. Who they kind of play all, like, in that world too. The reason why it's just an interesting, cool idea, like, period, mm-hmm. point blank period. But also what I think is interesting is that she created a communal space out of what she had. And I think that is such a story that we kind of all need to digest, that sometimes the barrier is the rent at another place. Sometimes mm-hmm. the barrier is the upkeep at another place. Or do you even want to do that? Sometimes I think about having a brick and mortar, for some people does feel like a vanity project more than it feels mm-hmm. like a project that's actually addressing the people who are living in this world. And this, because she was already going to be paying her rent here, she already had the space, and she decided to recreate it into a communal space. She decided to make it a space where people could interact with music, interact with older Black music. I say this also, another reason why this feels really important is because I think the preservation of specifically older Black music is really, really, really important. And so I've been looking at, I inherited my grandfather's record collection. He had thousands of records, and they're all around my apartment. But of course I like the Frankie Beverly and Maze, the Earth, Wind & Fire, but there's so many artists who I've never heard of. I Google them, they're not there. I go on Spotify, they're not there. They might have only had one album. They might have only been location specific. And I think about how we can be on the internet or be on social media, and how we can say, oh, this is a good thing to do. But sometimes it does take a person saying, come to my house and do the thing. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about your getting a record player. Don't worry about doing your deep dives. I did that for you. Just get to my address, and I'm going to transform my living room into a space where more people can commune and listen to this music. So I just think this was such an inspiring way to think about space where you live. I think it feels anti-colonial, because I think about the privatization of property. I think about individualism. So I think about how anti-colonial it is to have a place that's, you know, inside of colonialism, supposed to be just for you and private. And you actually say, you know what, I'm actually going to queer that idea mm-hmm. and make it public and make it a place for make it a place for community. It just has inspired me so much. And I love this story, and it made me feel so warm. And again, Black people do. I'm so glad that I pushed myself to look for Black people doing really innovative work during this mm-hmm. time, because I have not been disappointed. There has been so many findings of Black people doing just amazing, cool, interesting things in order to preserve their history. And the last thing I'll say about it is, like, the vibe of it is like, I'm trying to say this appropriately. the vibe of it is like, oh, we've been here before, mm-hmm. so let's freak it. Like, mm-hmm. like, it's almost like we're so bored with the oppression that we're constantly facing that the ideas are getting more elevated and more interesting and more avant-garde. And I really love that, too, because a part of me, Sharonda knows this, DeRay knows this, like, anybody knows me knows this, is I really have been... scared for the Black avant-garde and the Black mm-hmm. avant-garde ideas and those ideas getting to community and not just staying in galleries or theaters, but getting to regular, ordinary people. Because I think that Black avant-garde pushes our imaginations forward. And I love seeing people, you know, just morph their ideas into something that is still really nutritious for the Black community. I'm sure you all can hear it. Like, I can't stop smiling about this story because it just makes me feel so good to see it. Like, and you have to see the pictures because she's sitting down and she has her wood grain furniture and she looks really cool and people get to be inside of it. And I'm like, yes, this is what we need. And again, this is something the state can't take from her. This is something yeah. that nobody can take away from her. This is my living room, you know? And I think yeah. sometimes it does call for that. Yeah. I know how you feel about Sharonda, but the listeners don't. How did you feel about it?
Well, I am really grateful for what has become somewhat a standing segment on this podcast, right? Because it's also forced me to look at and look for things like that I might not have otherwise looked at or looked for. Even as someone who was surrounded by, as you are coming to know, Miles, right? Lots of people who do this kind of work, who are always thinking about our histories, our stories, our art, preserving those things, sharing those things. What I loved about this was first I saw it and I was like, aw, vinyl, and preservation, this is a Miles story, right? But to your point about the aesthetic, one of my aunts had this friend named Ruby, and Ruby's living room looked like this. Ruby's living room had beaded curtains. That's a whole other thing. I think Ruby was, okay. you know, Ruby. But they're like, I immediately felt transported to a moment, and all of those feelings were warm for me based just on how she had set up her living room, right? And I also think it's beautiful that, like, while she created this space in her home, that it is, I hate to call it elevated, so forgive me for the use of that word and that term, but like, it's not going to be part of a festival, right? Which I hope inspires other people, that is going to be on this bigger platform. People are going to see it. The other thing that I thought of was like, I have a home and I have resources and, you know, I don't know anything about this woman or her life, but I have quite a few resources at my disposal, right? Like, how am I leveraging my home to also create spaces for Black people to come together around things that are different than what I usually host, right? So like, I'll host a fundraiser, you know, all of those things people would like to reach yeah. out to me for, but like, I have interests that I would just like to share with people. And can I think about doing that beyond like my three or four homegirls who come over for our wind down? So it's actually this story in particular, and maybe the series of stories that we've covered in this same vein have really inspired me to think about what I might do in this world and in this way that are not about my work and that are not about my activism, but are about just creating spaces for Black people to be Black together. Because in LA especially, those spaces are fewer and far in between.
And it's so important because you see that when we don't do those spaces, I don't know about you. Well, I do know a little bit about LA. I have folks in LA. I don't know if y'all's spaces overlap because I'm in Black queer trans land a lot oftentimes. But a lot of the conflicts, a lot of mm-hmm. the not understanding different people's cultures is because sometimes when we do come to convene, it is centered around politics or work. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't actually give us a space to really figure ourselves out. The other thing that I wanted to say that your comment reminded me of is because DeRay's in the jail and I always comment about how bad the jail looks and it's for kids. As ridiculous as it might sound, unfortunately, could you only imagine if the kind of communal Black aesthetics that we're all familiar with, you know, like you saw those aesthetics and you're like, oh, this took me to Ruby and I see those aesthetics and mm-hmm. it takes me to people who are recreating that, but it also takes me back to my family history and pictures that I've seen. Could you imagine if Black kids who were in a rehabilitation space were surrounded by things that felt that familiar and that beautiful. And could you imagine the different way that they would feel valued just by the aesthetics of a space? And I think that, again, we undervalue it oftentimes as an American society, but it is often weaponized against us. It gets taken away when they want us to feel enslaved, you know? So I think that just thinking of ways of how can we employ that and put that in spaces where people can feel that warm. This feels valuable that we have like an aesthetic language that somebody can walk into and feel like, this makes me feel like I have family, even when nobody's in there. And I'm like, how do we use that feeling, you know?
Yeah. Go see the show, y'all, if you're in Philly.
Go see the show. You all have a good week and we love you.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Now, there are a million wireless companies. I remember when I first got my cell phone, it feels like some of those companies that were around way back when I was 14 don't even exist anymore. But what is common about most of them is that they're just so expensive. But not all of the cell phone plans are expensive. That's why I'm here to talk to you about Mint Mobile. And if you're tired of overpaying for wireless, it's time to say yes to saying no. At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no. No contracts, no monthly bills, no overages, no hidden fees, no BS. And that's why you should make the switch to get premium wireless for $15 a month. You can ditch the overpriced wireless and the jaw-dropping monthly bills, the overages, the hidden fees, because plans at Mint Mobile start at $15 a month. And all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, which are delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. You know, I think about Cricket Media's favorite Mint Mobile subscriber, Nina, who said that making the switch to Mint Mobile was so easy. She even got the same phone number. And best of all, she's paying a fraction of what she's paying on her old plan with one of the big wireless companies. Ready to say yes to saying no? Make the switch at mintmobile.com/PSTP. That's mintmobile.com/PSTP. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time, new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
This week I sat down with author and historian LaShawn Harris to chat about her new book, Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing that Galvanized New York City. Her book highlights the life and 1984 murder of a beloved Black grandmother that changed community activism forever. It was an early and important marker in the ongoing fight against police violence. Read the book. I learned a lot about this incident, and I knew nothing about Eleanor Bumpers before the book came out. So it was important for me. I think you'll like it too. Here we go. Professor Harris, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start talking about the book, the incredible story of Eleanor Bumpus called Tell Her Story, which has a great cover, everybody. Not all the books have great covers, but this is a very cool cover as well.
Thank you.
How did you get to academia? What's your story? How did you get to the field of study?
Well, I'm from New York City. I'm from the Bronx. I went to three HBCUs, Virginia Union, Virginia State, and Howard University, and majored in history and thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but didn't want to take the LSAT to get into law school. But I always loved history. I read a lot as a child and I had good history teachers. And just when I got to college, I've had great professors and just wanted to stay with it. I was always interested about the past, as well as, you know, the many genealogies of like current movements. So I graduated from Howard University in 2007, and my first job was in Georgia in a small town Statesboro, Georgia, and I've been at Michigan State since 2008, but I've always had a love of history. Growing up in New York, you know, we had libraries all around us. My mom, you know, went to school. She was a college student when we were, you know, in elementary and junior high school. We did a lot of museum, you know, stuff, but I've always, you know, I just loved reading about history.
I love that.
Yeah.
Shout out to mom. And how did you get to the story of Miss Bumpus, Grandma Bumpus? How did you get to her story?
You know, Eleanor Bumpers lived across the street from me. I was 10 years old. Yes. I was 10 years old when she was killed by the police on October 29th, 1984. I was actually, I just turned 10. And I didn't know her as a child, but my parents had dogs. And her daughter, Mary Bumpers, had dogs. So we were neighbors in that sense. We became, you know, my parents became, you know, friendly with her daughter. And, you know, coming out of writing, like going into writing a second book, my first book is on 1920s, 1930s, like Numbers, Runners, Madam Stephanie Sinclair Bank, you know, that sort of underground economy type of thing. I wanted to do something that was different. I wanted to still be in New York. I still wanted to do the urban stuff. I wanted to follow Black women. I wanted to follow this line of policing. But I was really curious about, so much has been written about Harlem. I'm not from Harlem. So I really wanted to kind of understand like my community. And after like kind of engaging and talking to my parents about like the history of our neighborhood, you know, they were like, you know, like this happened here, right? And I started thinking about it and I was like, yeah, I kind of vaguely remember this incident because it was Halloween. Eleanor Bumpers was killed 2 days before Halloween and the kids in the neighborhood had you know, made plans to go trick-or-treating in the projects where she lived as well as in the neighborhood. But that particular year, we could not go because after she was killed, the NYPD, newspaper reporters like Jimmy Breslin, Ed Codwell, and others had kind of swarmed the neighborhood. So kids couldn't go trick-or-treating because the neighborhood was so chaotic. So we ended up trick-or-treating in, you know, our apartment building, which is something that we hadn't planned. So I really wanted to understand, you know, what type of upheaval that particular incident caused in the neighborhood. And I really wanted to understand, like, what did Bronx folks, initially I thought it was just Bronx people, like, what did the Bronx, what did they have to say about this? Like, how did they come out and, you know, perform activism for Eleanor Bumpers? So it was really a calling, you know, kind of doing something on, like, where I grew up. I was interested in the upheaval that it caused on my community and my neighbors. And I really wanted to understand the sort of kind of aftershocks of police violence on families. Like what happened to like Mary Bumpers? Like what happened to them? You know, they're in the spotlight doing activist work. They're grieving publicly. But what does, you know, what does that look like privately perhaps? Like how were they coping with the death of their mother, you know, days, months, and even years and decades after she had been killed?
I love the photos in this book. I was like, oh, yeah. This, I can like see what the daughter looked like and the mom, like I can see, you know, I was sad that so much of this felt familiar. Yeah. You talk about how they made her out to be violent and that wasn't true. Can you just take us back to the incident itself? Help us understand what happened as they said it was an eviction and clearly, you know, more happened, but take us there on that day.
Eleanor Bumpers, so I'm just going to backtrack just a little bit, but she had stopped paying rent in July of 1984. She was killed in October of 1984, but she stopped paying rent in July of 1984. And immediately after if you stop paying rent and you live in a public housing project, the NYCHA will initiate eviction procedures immediately. So that's what they did by, you know, it was their policy. And when they did that, some of those, they also had to inform her that she was being evicted. They did a house visit. And initially, she would not let them in because she was a person that suffered from mental health conditions. Initially, she did not let them. And eventually, she lets them in. And they see that she has a knife. But the knife that she carries is sort of like a security blanket. This is not a knife that she had used on people. There was no history of her being violent towards anybody with a knife. And once they they saw the condition of her apartment, which is really neat. They went into the bathroom, and in the bathroom, they found buckets of feces. That buckets of feces really made them want to get her out the apartment even more. So what they did was they had a psychiatrist who had been a consultant for the city, and he did a 30-minute interview with Eleanor Bumpers, maybe about 4 or 5 days before she was to be evicted. And he said that she, you know, was someone who does not know reality from non-reality. And they still continue to go on with the eviction. It's important to note that the city at any time could have stopped the eviction. They could have paid her rent, but they refused to do so because of municipal disinvestment as well as municipal bureaucracy. So the eviction did not happen. And I say that to say that even before the police officers went into her house on October 29th, 1984, she had already been harmed by the city because they did not give her adequate psychiatric services and they did not give her municipal services, which was to pay that rent. So on that particular day, the housing authority, they go out of their way to get her out of the apartment. They hire movers. They have two different police units. They have the housing police unit, which was not part of the NYPD. And then they have the emergency service unit officers. And these are the police that are kind of highly weaponized. They carry shotguns. They carry shields. They also had social workers outside of her apartment. And Eleanor Bumpers' hallway is really narrow. So there was a lot of people in that hallway. They go to the door. Mrs. Bumpers, can you come out? She refuses. You know, she curses at them. And they start taking the locks off the door. They take the locks off the door and they eventually go in. And according to police narratives and according to city narratives, she had the knife in her right hand and she was wailing and she was about to stab one of the officers. And Stephen Sullivan, who was holding the shotgun, shot her in her right hand and blew off 3 fingers. Now, normally you would think that if someone's 3 fingers are blown off a hand, there's no way you can still be holding a knife. According to police narratives, she was still holding the knife. She was still flailing her arm. So she was, you know, quote unquote, a danger. And then Stephen Sullivan shot her with the shotgun in her chest. She doesn't die right away. She actually has, they take her to the hospital. She has cardiac arrest on the way. And she eventually dies at Lincoln Hospital. And the neighbors, everyone heard the gunshot blast. When they took her out the building, there was, you know, bodily fluids, there was blood in the hallway, and neighbors could not believe what they had heard, and they definitely could not believe what they saw when they brought her out the building so bloody. I mean, this was a 66-year-old grandmother of 10, mother of seven, who had just been shot down by the police, and neighbors couldn't understand why police went in with so much heavy weaponry, right? You know, but they didn't see her as a grandmother or a mother. They didn't see her as a sickly person. They saw her as someone who was a threat, who was violent, you know, who was a heavy set woman who they felt could move her body in a particular threatening way to them.
Again, all too familiar. One of the things that I loved in the book is you talk about the Sedgwick Houses Tenants Association.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring this up is that, you know, this is my work today for the past decade has been issues of police violence, and I deal with so many families. And I am always frustrated by the way people talk about the organizing that happens afterwards. Yeah. People sort of think that it just sort of goes away. You're like, no, people, yeah. You might not see them on the news, but people are fighting. They are meeting about this stuff. So I know that to be true in the decade that I have done this work. And when I read this in the book, I was like, I knew it. I was like, I'm happy she put this in the book. Can you talk to us about why you included this part about the Tenants Association?
I wanted to show that the first wave of activism for this grandmother was local grassroots activism. And these were folks who had been seasoned activists who lived in Sedgwick houses. These have been people who had no experience as activists. But I wanted to show that these weren't like national leaders. I wanted to show that these were not people who lived in, like Herbert Daughtry is a big part of this movement, but he lives in Brooklyn and he's a pretty well-known political activist throughout the late 20th century. But I wanted to show how her neighbors, like ordinary people who had been doing activist work prior to her getting killed, came in and really showed up for the family and really supported the family in really unbelievable ways. I mean, even them writing letters and trying to get Mayor Koch and Benjamin Ward, the police chief at the time, to issue an official city report. These are the people that helped pay for her funeral. So even, you know, beyond like the letters, the protests, the vigils, you know, if it wasn't for these local people, the neighbors, Eleanor Bumper's family, right, her daughter becomes an activist, she wouldn't have been buried. I mean, it would have been hard for the family to bury her. So the community really rallies around her. And the reason why I did that is because when we think about the 1980s, we think about like a kind of post-civil rights Black Power era, we tend to think that there's no political movements happening in the 70s and the 80s. But in fact, there are a whole host of local movements happening around the country, around a whole bunch of issues, including police violence. And it was really the purpose to kind of highlight, you know, organizations like the Sedgwick Tenants Association, as well as the women and men and even children who were out there side by side with David Dinkins, who, you know, was the first Black mayor of New York City, with Herbert Daughtry, with Roscoe Brown, who was the president of Bronx Community College, who was also former Tuskegee chairman, who were right beside these kind of, you know, juggernauts of political activists marching with them. So I really wanted to understand the political activism, just kind of local, ordinary people, like grassroots folk.
You know, how small of a world it is. I didn't realize until now Herbert Daughtry's daughter, Leah Daughtry,
yeah,
who I know.
Yeah.
And I was actually on a panel with Herbert, I don't know, like 8 years ago in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It's a small Black world. Yeah. It is a small world.
Yep. And I interviewed him twice. And there's actually a picture of Leah Daughtry and maybe two of her other sisters and her mother and Herbert Daughtry on the cover of the Daily Challenger, which was a Brooklyn newspaper, holding up a sign like justice for Eleanor Bumpers. But I wasn't fortunate to get the interview with Leah.
It is a small world.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
When you talk about the funeral, I also love that you, that there's the scene in here and like what people said at the funeral, what that looked like. I was shocked to see Ruby Dee.
Yes. Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis. They had been comrades with Daughtry. So when Daughtry becomes, it's really similar to like Benjamin Crump, right? Or Al Sharpton. Mm-hmm. So when they come to a movement, they're bringing all of their political contacts, you know, they're bringing all of their friends and all of the folks that they know. So Daughtry and Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis were comrades. And you know they're also from New York too, so they definitely heard about the case. But I found that when Daughtry and Wendell Foster and David Dinkins was the city clerk at the time, when they get involved, there's a host of other kind of you know, well-known political activists and, you know, entertainers that get involved. There's actually a really great photo that Daughtry has at his church. I could not get permission to use it, where it's Herbert Daughtry, David Dinkins, and Ozzie Davis, and a few other activists. And it's at Eleanor Bumper's funeral. And they're kind of just like looking down at her in the casket. And Ozzie Davis is looking away. So I said to Reverend Daughtry, like, what is he looking at? Like, why is he looking away? And he said that Ozzie Davis could not look at her while she was in that casket. So they also, too, become a part of this kind of, you know, grassroots movement that really becomes a citywide, you know, movement for legal justice for Eleanor Bumpers.
You know, I'm going to ask you, can you talk about what happens with her family following this? And one of the reasons why I was so excited to talk to you is that we still support Mike Brown's mom. So we essentially staff her foundation. We meet with her every week. We fund the scholarship in Mike's name. She doesn't celebrate August 9th when he was killed. She only celebrates his birthday.
That's right.
So we throw a birthday party for him. So we are with Leslie a lot. We're like just always with Leslie.
Yeah.
And I have been able to see what, it, you know, his death in so many ways sort of reignited this protest for my generation around the police. And so many people sort of forgot about Mike's brothers and sisters. They forgot about his mom. And you do such a good job in here of refusing to let people forget about Mary, like the, you know, Mary and everybody around Eleanor. Can you talk about that part of this story?
Yeah. I was really influenced by the reading of memoirs from survivors. So Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin's memoir of Trayvon Martin, Gwen Carr's memoir of her son, Eric Gardner, Emeril Gardner's memory of her father, Eric Gardner, Brenda Stevenson, who's a historian at UCLA, her conversations, her book on Latasha Harlins, who was killed in LA in the 1990s. So I was really influenced by like what families were saying about their loved ones, but also their experiences after, like after these things had happened. And even after legal justice was not had, right? Like what happened to these families, like, you know, in those moments, but also like years down the line. And I thought that was I thought that was like missing in like a lot of the historical scholarship. And I really don't hear, I mean, I don't know about, I know the activists are definitely on the front lines doing this, but I don't hear like a lot of historians talking about these kind of aftershocks of violence. I mean, some are really starting to do this when we think about like lynching victims, like, you know, who were these families who would have to go into these woods and take down their loved ones, you know, hanging from trees. So I was interested in what that looked like for Mary. And I keep saying Mary because Mary was the spokesperson for the Bumpers family. And she was the only family member that would talk to me. And she was the only one that would talk to me. And she was, you know, she fought for her mother, but she was a reluctant activist. Like this was someone who was, you know, unemployed, who was looking for a job. She was a single mom with three kids. You know, she also thought about the potential backlash of going up against the police and the city, right? That would give anybody pause. But as a second daughter, she had told herself that what she couldn't do for her mother on that particular day, and Mary lived down the street from Eleanor Bumpers, she would do for her in death, which was to help her mother, fight, you know, fight for her mother. So I wanted to look, I wanted to think about, you know, her in those moments. And there were times where, you know, she said that, you know, she didn't feel like going to, you know, Herbert Daughtry's church in Brooklyn. Like she didn't feel like giving a press conference and having to answer like invasive questions about her mother or, you know, answer questions to the point where she has to prove that her mother did not, did not deserve to die, right? You know, she had to think about like her children. She had to think about like her other family members. And it makes me think about another case that helped me kind of shape this is there was a woman who died in December of 1984, maybe two months after Eleanor Bumpers, killed by a Black police officer in Queens. And that family did not become activists. And I interviewed those three, all of the children from that particular family. And it was because they didn't have the emotional bandwidth to do so. So that was the other side of it, right? The limit of my book, which I love, but the limit of my book is the kind is I feel like, you know, it would have been so great to talk to other family members who supported what Mary Bumpers was doing, but who did not become activists to see what like grief looked like for those people who don't become activists. But for Mary, I wanted to kind of understand like what that meant for her, like to kind of grieve publicly and do this really tremendous work at the same time where you don't have the emotional bandwidth to really do it, but you know that you have to do it.
And just take us through the aftermath. It is, again, as you know, like you know, what happens to the police? It just makes me sad to even ask because, you know, it just is a too familiar story. But, you know, what happens to the police? And then does the family get any settlement?
Yeah. So in New York, in the Bronx, they had I guess what we would call a progressive DA, Mario Merola. I say progressive. He was a Democrat. He had been in office since the 1970s. And this was a DA who went after cops. Like he was not afraid to prosecute cops for like, or just try to have them indicted for like murder, manslaughter. So the police union, the BPA at the time, did not like him. So he brings Stephen Sullivan, the case, to a grand jury in about between November and December of 1984. And by January, the end of January, 5 days after Bernie Goetz, the subway vigilante who shot four African-American boys in December of 1984, they call him the subway white man who shoots for black men, Stephen Sullivan is indicted. And that's the end of January. And the indictment is actually, and he's indicted for manslaughter, not murder, manslaughter, which, you know, the family was not that thrilled with. They were happy that an indictment happened, but they wanted murder. And Daughtry also, activists, wanted murder. The indictment is actually thrown out twice, you know, by the local courts, by the state court, and eventually in November of 1986, the indictment is reinstated by the Court of Appeals. And by 1987, the end of January, February, they go to trial, which is bittersweet for the family because so many families don't make it into a courtroom. And that happened a lot during the 1980s. And Stephen Sullivan elects for a bench trial, which is a trial by judge, not a trial by jury. They were afraid that jury would be, you know, it's in the Bronx. So they were afraid of Latino jurors as well as black jurors. So they elect for a trial by judge, and he's acquitted. So between 1984 and 1987, there's a 3-year battle for the family, for activists, and for the legal community in the Bronx to bring Stephen Sullivan to justice. The settlement, they filed for a lawsuit of $10 million in December 1984, a couple of months after Eleanor was killed. And the case is not settled until the early 1990-1991. And the person who settles it, they settled under David Dinkins. By that time, he becomes the mayor. They sued for $10 million, and they actually, the city gave them a little over $400,000. However, the city placed a lien on the money because, you know, they surmised that they had paid over the women, the daughters. They'd given them too much money in welfare benefits. So the daughters only get, you know, they only get about $200,000. Which is not a lot. It's not a lot of money. It's more money than they had ever had. But it's five daughters. Two of them had died by that time. So each of them get a little under $20,000, which is, again, it's a lot of money, but at the same time, it's not a lot of money. So they don't get any legal justice at all, really. And they have to live with the fact that, you know, Stephen Sullivan, the person who shot Eleanor Bumpers, he gets promoted to detective. You know, he goes on to stay in the force for the next, you know, 20 years. And actually, he just died this summer. Yeah.
I didn't know that R.G. Lord has a poem dedicated to Eleanor Bumpers. You know, when I read this, I was like, I need to go search everything. I'm like, I've never heard of Eleanor Bumpers. I'm like, this is...
Do the Right Thing was dedicated to the 1989 Spike Lee film was dedicated to Eleanor Bumpers, graffiti artist Michael Stewart, Edmund Perry, all of those, you know, New Yorkers who had been killed by the police. Spike Lee in his first film, She's Gotta Have It, has like a little collage with Eleanor Bumpers. Towards like the end of the movie, Nola Darling is sitting in front of her mirror and there's like a clipping of like Eleanor Bumpers from the New York Daily News. And then all of the music, like all of the rap music, you know, where rappers are just, you know, saying her name, right? So this is someone that, and I think, you know, if you're of a certain generation, probably, right? But more recently, Tamika Mallory, her organization, I think it's called Until Freedom. Mm-hmm. She did a protest rally in New York City, maybe like in 2021. Something like that. And the protest rally was a tribute to families but specifically to Breonna Taylor and Eleanor Bumpers, like two Black women who had been killed in their house by police.
Look at that.
Yeah.
How do you think about this killing in the context of today when there's been a reignite? I mean, today is sort of brutal because Trump, what are we doing? But, you know, this entire last decade of protest is a reemergence in so many ways. And these are the types of stories that preceded my work that I did not know about. And when I got this book from your team, I'm like, well, I've never heard, you know, I know Amadou.
Sure.
I know Sean Bell.
All right.
These are the names that I knew before Mike Brown got killed. And now I know, you know, a million since he was killed. But how do you think about this story in the context of today? Or how do you think about this issue as it continues, especially since you lived across the street from Ms. Bumpers?
You know, it's so, I think you opened up, you know, correct. It's so sad that we have to keep talking about these killings, what's happening to Black people, even if they're not killed, what's happening to them on a daily basis with police harm and just state violence. And the thing that I would say is that after Eleanor Bumpers was killed, there was a host of reforms, right? A host, you know, it was a host of reforms. In fact, the policies that the police used on her was a reform since the late 1970s. And since then, since the 2010s, 2020, there have been a host of reforms that the NYPD has implemented. Those that pertain to de-escalation, and those that pertain to encounters with persons with mental health conditions, right? And if you believe in reform, that's fine, but people are still continuing to die, right? People are still continuing to die at the hands of police. So for me, you know, reforms don't work at all. I mean, I think about the death of, you know, Deborah Danner in 2016, same, you know, Bronx, 66 years old, you know, someone with mental health challenges. This was the officer that went into her apartment was supposedly a trained officer, right? But she still ends up dying. I think about the case of, you know, Wynn Rosario in Ozone Park in Queens. Another person with mental health challenges dies at the hands of police. So these are kind of ongoing things. What's hopeful for me is people like yourself, you know, people who are doing the work to challenge police and the state, especially when it comes to reform, and activists who are staying the course with families. And I think that's so important, especially given we're seeing the, you know, more occupation in police in places like DC, maybe coming Chicago, maybe New York next, definitely in LA. And we see that, you know, a lot of this is being sanctioned not only by the federal government, but also by local officials, right? So I think that reform is tricky. I don't think reform works, but I have faith in the work of activists who are like on the ground doing the work that needs to be done.
Boom. There we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is so interesting to think about how much has changed and how much has not. You're like, yeah, you know, whoa, like we are chipping away at it. And it still is like, gosh, you know, one of the things that I've learned is before the protest started, I would say that the police don't have to follow any rules. Like that was, I was like, you sure. know, the police did it. And as now with the work that I do, I'm like, oh, the police are following rules, but they are rules that they made up for themselves just a mess. I'm like, this is
right.
crazy. Like I think right. about, we have the only database on police union contracts in the country. In that database, we have 3,000 contracts. We look for 6 things in them. We've coded them. In Detroit, the contract literally says, if you get convicted of domestic abuse, you get put in like desk duty for 9 months, but you cannot be fired for the purpose of overturning the conviction. That's what the contract says. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, this is crazy. Yeah.
And a lot of, I mean, the other thing about the police, at least in New York, is the union. Like the union is so powerful and they are tied to politics. I mean, people know that you know, in New York, it would be hard to get elected without the support of the union, right? That's why this election coming up, the mayoral election, I can't vote. And I mean, you know, I live in Michigan now, but it's going to be interesting. But we know with this current administration, you know, we have a mayor who, you know, former police officer, but someone who was heavily supported by the by the police union, right? So it's those policies, right? Those things are kind of like ironclad policies until something happens, right? And once something happens, there's more policies again that support the conduct of police and policing, not the people.
It is interesting too in New York City. You know, we do work around the Civilian Oversight Board, which is one of the most well-funded in the country. They're all sort of mediocre, but this one is well-funded.
Yeah.
But when we tell people that they can only make a recommendation, they're like, "What?" Yeah. You're like, yeah, if they could actually fire people, game on. We would
right.
be.
Right.
But they can only make a recommendation. You're like, that's right. not oversight.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. And there's so many people who have different, you know, experiences and interpretations. I'm talking about civilians with police, even Black and Brown folks, right, who are all for the various levels of policing. You know, I had these conversations about more police on the subway, more police in around the neighborhood, and folks are like, "Yeah, this is what we need, right?" And I understand that crime is definitely an issue in certain communities, but people feel like, you know, with police presence, that they feel more protected, right? And then I think you just have to question that.
What advice do you have for this new generation of people coming to this issue, if you have any? And then I want you to tell us, where do we go to stay in touch with you? Is it Facebook? Is it Instagram? Is it Twitter? Is it snail mail? What's the thing?
I think the most important thing for activists and scholars is to tell stories, complete stories of, state violence victims, right? You know, we enter into situations at the moment that they died, right? You know, we've seen the videotape of George Floyd. How much do we know about George Floyd? You know, there's a brilliant book called His Name is George Floyd by, it's a co-author book by Robert Samuels, and I can't remember the other reporter's name who's actually on, I think, CNN a lot. But how much do we know about the lives of victims, right? You know, I think if we tell those fuller stories, we can really invest in the many different lives that they had. I also think it's important to think about families, right? You know, families, and, you know, not just during moments, explosive moments, but after the months and days and years, right? Because we also know that slow violence happens to families. You know, this kind of veiled type of violence, that's really gradual, that appears over time. And the other thing that I really love about this generation of activists is that they've connected these atrocities to other larger systemic issues happening within our community. So for example, Eleanor Bumper's death was connected to, you know, tenants' rights and housing rights and campaign against municipal disinvestment and neglect. I think it's good if activists can connect those deaths, those killings, those everyday harms to larger issues happening in the country and really the world.
Where do we go to stay in touch?
I am on Instagram as BronxHistorian08. Facebook, I don't know if people still use Facebook, but Madame Claire 08. And that's it.
Boom. Well, we consider you a friend of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharonda Bossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.